Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Startup Hustle podcast. I am your guest host, Melissa Vincent. I'm the executive director of Pipeline Entrepreneurs. And if you're wondering why I'm here, it is because Startup Hustle is being sponsored this week by Pipeline Entrepreneurs because we are in our recruiting season. So if you're an entrepreneur in the Midwest, that's Nebraska, Missouri, or Kansas, and you're interested in going through our fellowship program, go to pipelineentrepreneurs.com to apply and learn more. Today, I am so excited because I am joined by not only a Pipeline member, but a friend, Chris Motley with Mentor Spaces. And Chris, I'm just so happy to see your face and be here today with you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
So we have so many things to talk about, but we should probably start is telling your story and how you got here. Tell us about Mentor Spaces and why you are so passionate about your company.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Well, if I told you the whole story, we'll be talking for hours, but I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. But, you know, as you know, I'm from the south side of Chicago, where I grew up with my mom. And was very fortunate in learning about a program that really connected sort of young inner city kids with better sort of educational pathways, which, as we all know, tends to lead to better career pathways. Mm-hmm. And in this program, I met this individual who happened to be an oil trader at Goldman Sachs. And I had no idea what Goldman Sachs was. I thought it was a funny name, to be perfectly honest. And I had no idea what oil trading meant. And this individual spent time to just explain to me like what he did for a living. Nothing too fancy, nothing overly complicated. And there's no surprise. It's no surprise that I then went on not only to go to Columbia, where he went to college, but joined Goldman as an oil trader for a number of years. Hmm. And it was a phenomenal experience. And it's just crazy that had I not had that one conversation, I would have thought my career pathways were far more limited than they actually were. Mm-hmm. So when I left the industry, because I had made a little bit of money that allowed me to scratch this sort of entrepreneurial itch, I started the first company in the manufacturing space, which was amazing. It really taught me how to build a business, build a team, go out and sell and all of that stuff. And around that time, technology just became more accessible to me, where I can look and see that there was a path to create something if I just focused. And so I kind of took my own personal experience and said, wait, what if we can use technology to sort of create serendipity between, you know, young Black and brown kids like I was many years ago? And and connect them with people who can help them along the way. And that's sort of how we got to this point of where we are now with mentor spaces. Obviously, COVID starting, last March and in 2020, obviously almost a year and a half ago, which is crazy to think about. Yeah. And then all of the events of last summer with George Floyd and others certainly created this sort of environment that, you know, the market almost pulled innovation out mm-hmm. of my team and I. And mentor spaces has been very well received in the market. And effectively, what we're doing is exactly what my personal experience was. We're just doing it with technology, which allows us to scale.
So tell us a little bit about how that actually happens. So if I'm mm-hmm. someone who is in need of a mentor, or if I'm someone who wants to be a mentor, how does this happen?
Yeah, well, so it's a couple of things. So what we know and part of, what makes this approach so special is that there is already an established ecosystem in the Black and Latinx community. So one obvious sort of ecosystem player are historically Black colleges and universities who lack a lot of resources, but they are really trying to figure out how to better engage their alumni, as well as to better prepare their students for the world of work. And so part of our approach is partnering with these universities, partnering with national nonprofits who already have built a community, but they don't really have a connective tissue in terms of technology. And the way the product works is that, very clearly we help people clarify their goals, clarify how they're able to help others, establish an intended time commitment, particularly for the mentors. And then we integrate with their calendars to understand their availability. Mm-hmm. And so the machine, so to speak, collects inventory of experts' time. And then we distribute those time slots to individuals who would benefit from having conversations, whether in a group format or one-to-one.
That's amazing. So you're basically making it incredibly easy for someone who's a mentor to say, because if you are a mentor, you typically are someone who has a lot going on and yeah. and you want to give back your time, but it has to be, to your point, it has to be integrated and easy. So I love that you've made that so easy for the mentor to be able to just kind of, you take the legwork out of like, okay, when do I schedule? How do I make yeah. that happen?
And there's one sort of point of clarification, which is, when we talk about mentorship, we're talking about the practice of mentorship. And the role of a mentee or a mentor is very dynamic. If the subject matter changes, then someone who is a mentor in one context can be the mentee in another context. Mm. And that really is this community-driven approach, which is about sort of people sharing their lived experiences organized by technology, is what allows value to be delivered to everyone, regardless of if they're playing the role of mentor or mentee.
So if you are one, that was powerful. I just want to like pause, rewind that and be like, that being the mentor and also that shifting sometimes and you're the mentee is like the beauty of life, right? We should always be a little bit of both. So when you are looking at on the mentee side, how are you, is that where you're going through the like HBCUs or where are you focusing on that side?
Yeah. With many businesses, and increasingly businesses are becoming sort of B2B, B2C, distribution is always sort of the big hurdle that typically defines, success or failure. So this point about the ecosystem already existing, by partnering with national nonprofits who don't have sort of technology as a core competency, but cares about the goals that we're trying to achieve in the BIPOC community, they basically fork over their network and their community to us. And so it limits or enhances our ability to reach these audiences without having to rely on really expensive sort of social media marketing tactics, which, in some cases can work, right. but those tend to be amplifiers. My view is it can't be sort of the basis of your strategy unless you are selling something direct to consumers, right. They can buy at really nice margins.
Yeah. So one of the things that I know just because of knowing you is that the goal, or at least one of the goals, is to really help, going back to your experience of kind of like your why in doing this, is to help, that mentorship helps provide a better career path. So how do you make that happen?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. So the vision is advancing the careers of underrepresented talent. And the way that we execute that vision is through the power of mentorship. And when we think about sort of what mentorship means or what it is, at least the way we've defined it in our company, is it's a conversation with someone in the know. Yep. And if you can sort of break something down to its individual sort of unit of measure, it becomes very clear what you have to do. So what we have to do is continue to facilitate high quality conversations with people in the know. Yep. If my job, let's say, you know, what I focus on now is, you know, how do you, you know, take the traction that we've built thus far since we launched this product a year ago and scale into the enterprise? And so I seek out mentors who help me to do that. And it's one conversation at a time. And if you think about it, you have a single conversation, no different than the one you and I are having, and it sparks ideas. It sparks, oh, you should talk to this person.
Yes.
And ultimately, what we realized that in the BIPOC community, especially for folks entering their career, the key pain point is a lack of confidence. Mm-hmm. And that lack of confidence is fueled because they have a lack of social capital. They simply don't know people who work in various career paths. And the more that becomes pervasive, especially when people are increasingly isolated, it creates what, you know, I think LinkedIn may have coined this term, you know, the network gap. Mm-hmm. And if you can close that network gap, then you increase one's confidence and you reduce the friction that they would otherwise encounter in pursuing their careers. And mentorship does that. You know, you have a conversation with someone who demystifies the world of work, shares the language of industry with you. And very quickly you say, oh, I can speak the language. I now know someone in this particular sort of career path. And you're more prepared when it becomes time for an interview, you know, for that next opportunity. And so that's how we do it. And this is not limited to people who are also just coming out of college. The same issues exist when you are an individual contributor at a company 5 years in and you're trying to get to that next level. And we all know the problems of large enterprises who may do a really good job in attracting talent in entry-level roles, but most of them do have work to do when it comes to having underrepresented populations and mid-level and executive roles.
So one, I love that piece of it because there is that network gap. And to your point, it's only been made more apparent by COVID because people have become very isolated. And I think I always like to think of like a network as in, it's like a weird analogy, but Bermuda grass. So Bermuda grass is pervasive, like starts here and then it really kind of spreads out in this like network. And the reason why that's like, for whatever reason, always stuck with me is because if you don't have that person that can actually help connect you, then you're just this one little spoke. And being able to reach a network and all these various people that spreads out is something that most people that underrepresented groups do not have access to that.
And
getting a job in, you know, to your point, growing your confidence, like everything is about networking and who you know, and not having access to that is debilitating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly. And I think that, you know, obviously over the last, I guess, 10, 15 years, you have LinkedIn, you have Facebook, which are huge networks. And I think there's a shift and the shift, because at the end of the day, these networks have existed, you know, social networks, but we still have these problems.
Yep.
And so something is not being solved by the network. And so we prefer to think of it in terms of community. And so if you are part of a true community that's supporting your goals and your ambitions, then you can show up with your best self every single day. You know, if companies complain about retention of underrepresented folks, it's because they don't feel like they're part of the organization.
Right.
You can just substitute community for the word organization.
And right.
If you feel like you're part of the community, like if you take it down to the literal sense, you walk down the street and there's trash on the ground, you value that community. You like being a productive member of that community. You pick up the trash and throw it away. And so I think there's a shift that's happening that's going from networks to communities. And when we talk about social capital, it's really defined, at least for us, by the value or the advantage you have by virtue of who you know, who knows you, and how you know them.
Yeah.
And simply having a connection on LinkedIn is insufficient.
That's right.
Half the people who probably connect with me these days, I have no idea who they are. I'm like, I post something and now it spreads further, far and wide. So I'll do it. But everybody knows the issue with everybody getting these random emails in LinkedIn. Yeah. You're like, who are you? Network, not community.
That distinction is really important. And I think too, not to get more philosophical, but I think it's really the issue with, as we look at younger generations, again, not saying that I'm old, but when you look at younger generations who have grown up on social media, I think that there is a bit of an issue around actual depth in relationships because it is very surface level and you don't really know the depth of someone. And so those connections are not strong, right? It's like, oh, well, we're connected, but you're not really, again, the community piece is what's missing. And so I love that you're trying to solve that issue because I think it's an issue for, I think it will continue to be an issue for a long time based on what our society is focused on. And that is kind of the surface level snapshot of a moment versus real connection.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, people have been writing about this for thousands of years. We're just in a different point in time, but these things are consistent. I mean, everybody wants and needs human connection. And quite honestly, the one positive thing I could say about social media is that it at least shows you what people think is important to others.
Mm.
They try to project. And so it gives you a hint to kind of what they may really be thinking or facing. And it could provide sort of clues of how you can build a community.
Yeah.
You know, everybody gets fulfillment when they are growing
right.
and when they're contributing to others.
Yeah.
They just don't know the easiest ways to do that.
Right.
And so, you know, and I think the other thing I could say about social media from a positive light is it really taps into sort of these very, you know, these attributes that are part of our DNA. I think that, you know, they really rely a lot on FOMO and dopamine, right? And get these hooks in. And I think that there needs to be a shift to rely more on serotonin. You are feeling good because you're doing something positive and it's intrinsically good for you. And how might a social network of the future, based on serotonin versus dopamine and FOMO and what have you, how might that change things? I don't know. But these are the things that beyond the design and the buttons you press on the Mentor Spaces app, these are the things we obsess about to really, you know, use the lessons learned and the patterns that have been proven to work in sort of the social media context for something that's actually productive and helpful, right? And then we'll see what happens.
So I'm going to take a minute just to do our little sponsor piece, which is that, one, thank you to Startup Hustle Podcast for having Pipeline Entrepreneurs take over this week and talk about our new recruiting season, which starts now. So if you are interested in being an entrepreneur and going through Pipeline's fellowship program, go to pipelineentrepreneurs.com. to apply and find out more. So in talking through those pieces of how, one, we like the science behind all of that is really like incredible. I've never heard anyone kind of refer to it as like we're trying to get to the serotonin and not the dopamine. Like that's, so is that where you're headed, is really trying to add, like how do you accomplish that?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to what I was saying before and something you referred to, which is, you know, first of all, on an identity level, people want to be known as being helpful to others.
Yeah.
Whether it's true or not actually doesn't matter. People do want to be thought of as being helpful, right? Because people who are selfish are just not likable, right? And you don't trust them. So that's number one. So you have to tap into that sort of that identity that people want to be known for. The second point is that if you look at the problem or the barriers that exist in helping others, let's say in being a mentor, it's all the things you said. Well, I already have very little bandwidth. How exactly does that work? But the reality is everybody can make a commitment to 30 minutes a month,
right?
But they don't want to have to go find the person to help. They don't want to have to like go back and forth over email about what time is good for you, right? They don't want to feel like they won't do a good job. So training is important, right? And then you have to remind them that this is the very thing they want themselves. Like everybody has something to give and everybody wants to accomplish something. So if you organize a community dedicated to the practice of mentorship, again, regardless of the role you're playing one day as a mentee and the role you're playing another day as a mentor, it allows people to know with confidence that they are helping someone over a 30-minute period of time, no more, no less. They can choose more if they want or not. And it creates what we like to call mentor high. And it's that feeling you get when you know you've helped someone. You it's like seeing a kid learn something for the first time, right? You enhance their perspective in a way, and that stuff becomes really addictive in a positive way.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to generate. There's lots of ways to do it. One example sort of in the traditional kind of sense of mentorship is you help someone, you have a conversation. So A, the first complaint is, that guy didn't even thank me, you know? And let's say that basic thing is taken care of. The second thing is, it's like, I don't even know if I was helpful, right? Mm-hmm. So if you just close that feedback, if you establish that feedback loop and you can automate it in a way where it's still genuine and it's still authentic, but you make it easier for people to say thank you.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a confidence thing. I don't know exactly how to do it. And then like 3 days pass by and it's like, well, it's been 3 days. I think it took too long, so I'm just not going to do anything, right?
Right.
All of these things are what people go through. And so you can use technology to sort of nudge people in the right way to say, man, that conversation was awesome. Thank you so much. I learned this. And we all have gotten either someone saying that to us or emailing that to us and how that feels. If we can do that like a million times, then we'll be very successful.
I feel like as the mother of a 10-year-old son, I feel like you're basically putting the mom in their brain saying, did you say thank you? Thank you. Like, you're basically just being that helpful reminder to say, people intrinsically feel that, right? They feel thankful. It's just, you sometimes need a little nudge to be like, did you say it? And so I love that you're automating that. I feel like I wish I could use that with my son sometimes.
Well, you know, the big thing is that, you know, people don't know things until they know things.
And once you know, you know.
And so, again, part of the challenge and the opportunity is organizing a user experience in such a way that things that we may take for granted or things that we do like in a very sort of automated like reaction when you're 20 years into your career and you have experiences. Right. You bring it to, you know, populations who are sort of just starting out. Because again, if you don't know people who operate in this way, well, how would you know that that's the way to operate in terms of how to meet people, how to have a highly productive conversation? It's funny. There's a very simple question you can ask most people, especially young people, and they get stumped every single time. And the question is, well, what's your goal? What are you trying to accomplish? And it's so simple and it's so profound, but like, it's a really hard thing. Your goal is a function of your knowledge of your available options. This is very interesting thing in life of if what you do is a function of what you know about and what is available to you, then you benefit a lot by engaging in things that open up your options and open up your access. But if you're marginalized, if you're part of a marginalized community, as I am, you have to be aware of systemic things that can work against you, and then engage in communities where the goal is to overcome those things.
Again, another time where I really want to be able to go and say, okay, let's rewind that and listen to it one more time. So for anyone listening, rewind that and listen to it one more time, because it was really powerful. So one of the things I want to talk about, in again, the little things that I know that our listeners may not, you just closed a round of funding. So one, congratulations on that. That is no small feat. Congratulations. But tell us about, you know, before we actually kicked off, we were talking about how that takes a weight off. And then you immediately are like, okay, now I have to figure out how to, now I have to deploy it, which is a completely different, you know, challenge. So talk to us. So for those who are going through the fundraising piece right now, what are some things that you learned from that process, you know, that maybe you struggled with? And then it's like, okay, now that you're on the other side of it, tell us helpful insight for those who are struggling right now going through raising.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny. Well, you know, I don't know if this is going to be helpful, but if it's not helpful, I would say, listen to this part again, because you missed something. First of all, my perspective on most things in life is that we make, as human beings, for whatever reason, especially those of us who've been fortunate to have a great education and all of that stuff, we can make things super complicated. And part of what I do every day, regardless of if it's fundraising or hiring or what have you, I literally have to spend time to say to myself, Chris, you're thinking about it way too hard. You're making it too complicated. And when it comes to fundraising, it's actually a fairly simple process from the standpoint of, you know, the things to do. The execution of the things to do is where the rubber meets the road. And so there, it has to be maniacal practice in the execution. So number one, knowing your story, owning your story, and being able to articulate that in a way that connects your personal story to the opportunity you're trying to capture. You will be amazed. It sounds very simple, but it's really hard in executing it, because investors have their own stories. They have their own biases. They have their own sort of perspective. And so you have to sort of develop this muscle of reading that investor and making sure that the way you are telling your story and owning your story and connecting it to why you are the person to seize this opportunity is super important. I would connect this to really good musicians who have like a core song that everyone knows, but the musician, in order to keep it fun for the musician, they rearrange it 1,000 times. And that's what you get when you go to live music shows. You know it's the song that you like. And the musician gives you this little gift because they rearranged it where the meaning doesn't change, but the feel of it, it matches the moment. And I think that in owning the story and articulating that story, it's a very similar sort of muscle. The second point is that those of us who are really good at presenting and being very persuasive to a person who's investing their money, they're automatically going to say, okay, well, what's the plan? Right? And sometimes people who are very strong in presenting things are horrible at articulating a very succinct and clear plan. All the way down to the numbers. And oftentimes the reverse is true. People are very, very good on the plan, but they can't inspire anyone. And so that plan and the weaknesses that a person may present in articulating that plan needs to be addressed well before that conversation with the investor. And that just takes humility. And it takes, again, practice and, you know, challenging the assumptions. The next piece, which is related, is really recognizing that you are not going to do this by yourself. And if you can't talk passionately about individual members of your team, just as you may talk passionately about your own ability to get something done, again, it just creates cognitive dissonance. And so when that opportunity and that story is clear, that plan is clear, and that team is clear, then by definition, all the materials that sort of articulate that, like, what's the evidence? Right. Yeah. What's the evidence that it's an opportunity? What's the evidence that you're the person to do it? What's the evidence that your plan, you know, can sort of work? And what's the evidence that your team is capable? Then it's just the process, right? Yeah. It's how you communicate with people, how you follow up with people. And from an investor's perspective, especially early stage entrepreneurs who may be pre-revenue, they are looking at how you sell to them. Because that's the only proxy they have at your ability to sell to a customer to get revenue. Yeah. So there's lots of issues. There's lots of challenges. But it's hard for a reason. And I just had to obsess about all of the things I just said to get over the finish line.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, now I just graduated to the next set of problems.
So talk to us about where you are now. So where are you in the process? So now, so we've had the congratulations, okay, capital's raised, we've closed that. Now what?
Where are you? Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. This is real honest. I mean, if you're raising money for a long period of time, it took us a year to raise $2.5 million. And which means that you have to think about how long it's going to take you and you start that process. And the more down to the wire it gets, the less you're involved in the day-to-day operations of your business. But what I'm getting to, though, is that when you have your opportunity clear, your plan and your team and your materials and that's expressing all the evidence, it's just a snapshot in time.
Yeah.
So if you did this, let's say in January of 2021, and now it's, August 2021, there may be things that you have learned or that your team has shared with you that may have invalidated many of the assumptions or that snapshot in time in January when you were pitching your organization. Right. And so there's a discipline of like, yeah, I know I was going to invest in this thing, but I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to invest in this thing. And so for me right now, I ask myself a very simple question, which is, what has to be true for this thing that I want to happen?
Yeah.
And for us is we want to pursue a product-led growth strategy, which is users of our product have received value and they love it. And then they become the evangelist that leads to revenue. And in the enterprise context, Slack is an example of this. Dropbox is an example of this. Zoom is an example of this. In a product-led growth strategy, if that's what someone pursues in their go-to-market motion, then you have to obsess about product. Yeah. And you ask yourself, well, what has to be true for this strategy to be successful? And if you answer that question, it basically defines your strategy. And there's actually a really interesting hack to this. I kind of do the opposite. So I say, well, what would guarantee that my product-led growth strategy would fail? Right. And you just talk about the human mind that you can think about the negative much easier than the positive. And so you write things down like, oh, my onboarding sucks. Yeah. People don't know what they have to do. Value isn't clear and blah, 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 blah. And you come up with a list of maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 things. You ask your team the same question. They come up with their list. And that becomes the skeleton of your strategy.
Yeah.
You just prioritize it by the root dependency. And then it helps you make better decisions on where to allocate money. And then the second piece is just staying disciplined to that. Because I'm not a big shopper in terms of like material things, but everyone loves to shop, right?
Yeah.
And when you raise money, everybody's trying to put you in their sales funnel. And so being clear about sort of how you're going to make decisions and this strategy that I just shared is what we use. So that we're investing in the right things, because everything else doesn't matter if sort of that core dependency isn't addressed.
So I had to laugh when you were talking because we're so similar and my brain works the same way. I call it worst case scenario. So whenever I'm planning something, I'm like, what's the worst case scenario? And then I work backwards from there to say, okay, how does the worst case scenario from happening?
Yeah, so exactly. 100%
feel you on that. I mean, and that's something that I think, you know, comes with time, right? Like when you, it has multiple layers to it because it keeps you from panicking, right? Because ultimately when you're saying what's worst case scenario, as a founder, you're like, I know I'm not gonna let worst case scenario happen. And so here are the things that I need to do to make sure it doesn't. And there's a relief in that to say, okay, that's as bad as it can get. And I'm not gonna let that happen.
Yeah, and then I'll learn along the way, right? 100%. And, you know, maybe my, you know, former career in Wall Street biases me in this way, but it's all about risk. And so, you know, understanding how to measure it, understanding, you know, how comfortable you are with it and what you will tolerate and what you won't. And that's a very personal decision for every entrepreneur, which is why I never give advice. I just literally just share perspectives. Yeah. But it's all about risk and, you know, and what happens if you're wrong. That's one way to assess risk. And how much is that going to cost you? Right. And it all really comes down to that. And again, I may totally be biased because, you know, being a trader at a company like Goldman Sachs, that's literally you're in the business to make money. They make that very, very clear. And the way you do that is you are very good at managing risk, understanding managing risk.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I want to talk about and a little bit is, so you went through the pipeline program and, you know, the goal of the programming is to help you figure out how to scale and improve your company. And this year, one of the things that we're doing and one of the reasons why we took over Startup Hustle Podcast this week is because we're starting new programming. And so we are recruiting for two classes, which is the first time in the history of the organization that there's a second class starting. And so we have pipeline, what we'll refer to as pipeline proper, that you went through where you're working on your company full time and you are, you know, scaling and growing, and our job is to help you get there. What we realized during recruiting last year is that there is a whole group of people who do not have the access or privilege to just say, oh, I'm going to go start my company full time. And just because of the fact that they're not running their company full time, they are automatically disqualified from pipeline proper. So we created this second class, which is why we're doing so much kind of things like this, where we're sponsoring podcasts, because it's brand new, but it is for female minority and rural entrepreneurs only. And it is, we are taking what we learned from virtual and realizing that the people who have not had that even playing field to be able to get into pipeline, we want to give them a way to meet them where they are. So if they're working full time, they can't take the time off that you need to be in pipeline.
Yep.
And so it's a virtual program. It's in the evenings and weekends, same level of class, structure and, you know, the amazing resources that we bring in, very heavy on mentorship. And the goal is that when people go through the program, that we hopefully help them be able to get into pipeline, but then if not, that they'll be better situated and suited to be able to work on their company full time. Mm-hmm. And so in that process of going through pipeline, what was something that you really kind of took away from, like, how did it help you kind of think about building your business?
Yeah, well, first, let me just say, I think that's a great initiative. And it's tied to the earlier conversation around risk, because when you talk about underrepresented folks, this is true with everyone. It's just amplified when you get into marginalized populations. There's real opportunity cost, right? Even though I had a successful career and I then pivoted and jumped into entrepreneurship, that was a very high opportunity cost in terms of what I was making and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But other people have opportunity cost of, you know, maybe they have a young one at home and, you know, And taking a full plunge into entrepreneurship can be just way too daunting. And I think the program basically mitigates the risk for someone to pursue entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Right. And it, yeah. and it makes it more accessible. So kudos to you and the organization for coming up with that, because quite honestly, that's how I started. I kind of in nights and weekends sort of flirted with these ideas, got involved in the community. And there were a few sort of organizations that helped along the way. But after 3 or 4 months of doing this, I said, oh, I could do this. And then I quit the job and like jumped off the edge of the cliff. So kudos. I think it's phenomenal, and it's really addressing some of the core problems that underrepresented folks face in thinking about entrepreneurship. Now, in terms of how Pipeline helped me, I think it's like everything, perspective. Being around your peers. And all entrepreneurs are peers. People are just at a different stage of the process, right? It's like being an athlete, right?
Yeah.
Trying to perform at the highest level. People can empathize aware what you're going through, and that's comforting. People can also, they've earned the right to speak to you in a very direct way because they're on the journey with you. And I think that sort of tough love is super important to keep it real and authentic. And which basically created this environment to be very vulnerable. And so you create these bonds with people that last a long time. I was in Pipeline, I don't even know how many years ago it's been now, maybe 6, right? My business is completely different than it was when it was in Pipeline, but those relationships are still there. And it's just cool knowing that, all I'm thinking about right now as I'm answering this question is the movie Gladiator. Mm. And, they're all in the middle of the ring and, trying to come together so they all don't get killed and become animal food, right? And to me, that's what I felt. It was that other people who I was interacting with were in the arena with me. Maybe their goals are different, their companies are different, but we all are trying not to be skeletons in the graveyard of failed businesses. And that's cool. Versus someone sort of telling you, I love hip hop music, and in particular, Jay-Z has this line in one of his songs. He's like, everybody tells you how to do it and they never did it. And that's basically everybody who's not an entrepreneur trying to empathize with you. But so you have to have vetted networks to make sure that, you're getting the right support, and that's what Pipeline helped me to realize I needed, even before I knew I needed it. And now I can't live without it. So.
Yeah. And kind of going back to the very beginning of this conversation it's about community, right? And it's about having, as an entrepreneur, you need to have other like-minded people who are going to support you. And the thing that I love about Pipeline is that it's serial entrepreneurs. And so every single person that I can think of that has had exits or multiple exits, they had failures. And we all need that reminder sometimes that at some point, failure is not a bad thing. You learn so much from it. But again, having that perspective and the community of people who, when you're going through a moment where you're like, pivot, stop, what do I do? Having other people who care about you, who want to see you succeed, but are also going to give you tough love when you need it. That's a very valuable element to what makes Pipeline, in my mind, special, is other people who care about you, who have been there, who are in the trenches now and are like, hey, perspective. And
yeah.
That's what people need.
Yeah, 100%. And by the way, people who haven't failed are just not interesting people, right? And when have you ever read a book that's like, John was born, he's great. Never sucked at anything. No movie has started. Nobody could ever go back to. It's a very clear pattern of sort of the hero's journey.
Yeah.
And those are the stories that you know, whether it's Star Wars or what's happened recently in the Olympics with Simone Biles. I mean, this is the thing that human beings are attracted to. So it's sort of like the whole perspective. Maybe you need to come up with a new word. It's not failure. You're just not interesting as a person.
No, not at all.
And it's not even, who wants to talk to a person like that?
Because it's not real. I mean, and I always say, like, I think the more things that you go through, the more ability you have. You have an opportunity, right? You have an opportunity to either become, like, kind of bitter as difficult things happen, or you have this ability to become more open and compassionate and gracious to other people because you recognize that we've all gone through things. Yeah. And so the hope is that you don't become bitter, but instead you become a mentor, someone who says, I've been there and I can help see you through this because I know exactly what you're going through because I've been there too.
Yeah. Well, I think being bitter has its value too, right? And you know, you see this in, let's say, like the Jordan documentary.
That was so good.
And I grew up in Chicago. So it's like that was like what I grew up on.
That was life.
Like, it's just this point of like, you use that bitterness to get a competitive advantage. You know, we raised money, as you noted, and we wanted to get a feature story in a major publication. And the response was, oh, this round isn't big enough, right? Mm. And I'm just like, wow, how do you write articles that talks about how difficult it is for Black founders to raise venture capital? And then when one actually raises venture capital, you say, oh, the round's not big enough, right? Yep. It's just crazy to me. So I'm a little bitter about that. And I'm a little in my feelings about that. But that's what motivates me, right? I'm like, okay. And I'm just thinking to myself, okay, one day it's going to be a feature story and it is big enough. And you're like, why didn't you give it to me, Chris? So I was like, oh, well, you know, your publication wasn't important enough to me anymore. You know, so it is a role. You have to know how to challenge it. And very, very clear, this is not easy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I don't know who I learned this from, but I've never forgotten it, which is it's very important to embrace those, you know, failures and those sad moments and those bitter moments, but you just can't stay there. Right. That's the key. Yep. You can't stay there. Right. You know, I've been knocked in the mouth and on my back many times, but it's just like, I'm not going to stay on that. I might rest for a few seconds. Like, man, that was rough.
And the older we get, maybe it's a few more extra seconds. Exactly.
You know, it's like Rocky Balboa. Like, all right, let me just get to the ropes. One step at a time. You know, you can't stay there. So that's what keeps, you know, at least me sort of grounded through all the things, both positive and not so positive.
That's exactly right. You know that you're going to keep getting back up. And that is the gift of being an entrepreneur, is that we all have this kind of common trait, which is, especially if you're a serial entrepreneur, it is, you can knock me down and that's fine, but I'm going to keep getting back up until finally at one point you've grown resilience and strength and you just,
100%.
Yeah, it's not going to stop me. Worst case scenario is not going to happen. I mean, that's why we're playing against it.
Exactly.
Well, Chris, tell us how we can connect with you. So there are, one, I have to say again, as we wrap up Startup Hustle, thank you so much for letting us take over this week. And Pipeline Entrepreneurs is just so appreciative of the work that you guys are doing to tell the stories of entrepreneurs just like Chris. And so thank you for that. If you want to find out about Pipeline, either one of our programs, go to pipelineentrepreneurs.com to apply and find out more. So Chris, tell us how we can get in touch with you.
So it's crazy because, as I said, you raise money and everybody finds your email and I have like 1,000 emails.
How did you
just like, but you can get in touch with me at chris@mentorspaces.com. You should see my inbox is crazy, but I do look at all my emails. And you can just check us out on mentorspaces.com. And you know, we have a team that's active on social media. So if you like what we're doing, feel free to keep spreading the word because, who can't get behind helping other people advance in their careers, right?
Amen. So
thanks for having me. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much. And Startup Hustle, thanks for having us. Until next time.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.